particularly interested in continuing with the ballot process.
The well-known facts, I really don't want to spend much time on. The fact that Parsha Zohar is clearly considered a mitzvah deraisa. The only one of the Dalit Parshas that's agreed to is deraisa. There is a view in a Tosfos that says that Parshas Poros is also deraisa. The Vilna Gaon found it so bizarre that he said that Tosfos must be a mistake in the text of Tosfos. But we found, you know, the researchers have found another about 2-3 Rishonim that also support this view that Parshas Poros is deraisa. We'll come to that. I mean, the problem with Parshas Poros is where does the Torah tell us to read Parshas Poros? At least by Parshas Zohar, the Zohar is Asher Osa L'chol HaMolek. The Gemara has a drosha that if it's only shikcha v'leiv, so it says, let's say shochach at the end. It says loy. But it says loy tishkach. I'm sorry, not loy shishach, loy tishkach. So Yocho, so that clearly like Tishkoch is below. So Zohar, this is Bepeh. So at least some mocker, right? The Gemara Dasha, that has to be from a Sefer. So if that's the Raisa, it's not the Raisa. But at least the mitzvah per se is in the Raisa. That we know. What exactly is necessary to fulfill this mitzvah? This is also a matter of dispute. You know, typically we read from the end of Parshas Kisetze. Now, the Shulchan Aruch raised the question, in Eastern Europe, it was common because earning a livelihood was so difficult that a family or two lived off in the countryside on their own with all non-Jewish neighbors. And they ran some type of a general store or something that, you know, Jews were into running. And that's where they earned their livelihood, supplying the peasants. And they were called the Bnei Yeshuvim, or the Yeshuvnikas. And they did not have an easy time, because their children grew up in a very non-Jewish atmosphere. But this was a standard feature of the Middle Ages, and into even more recent times. So the Shulchan Aruch writes that the Bnei Yeshuvim, the people that live in these places, he says in Parshas Zohar and Parshas Poro, they have to show up in town, to a town, and somehow attach themselves to a minion, so they should hear Parshas Zohar appropriately, read in the normal fashion. So Parshas Poro is disputed. So now there's a Shaila. The Shaila is, what happens, this year, life is convenient. Parshas Zohar is Shabbos, Sunday is Purim. What happens if Parshas Zohar is Shabbos, for example, and next Friday is Purim? So this guy from the Yishuv can't sit here for a whole week. He has a wife and kids. He has to run his business. And to come twice is overly difficult to go away. So the Shaila is, so when should he come? Should he come to hear the Kriyas HaMegillah? Or should he come to hear Parshas Zohar? So most of the world said that he should come to hear Parshas Zohar. That's the Raisa. And Megillah, basically, a Yotzei on Yudalar HaTezvav, even if you read it be Yechidus, it's better not to do such a thing, Baroivam and Pursum and Isa, but bottom line, Yeitze. Along came the Mogen Avram, and the Mogen Avram said that he descends. He said if he has to choose between the two, we should choose to come Purim and stay home for Shabbos, Parshas Zohar. Why? Because on Purim, he could be Yeitze both. If he Yeitze the Megillah, and we read the Parsha of Vayavo Amalek. And there it says, Timche Zecher Amalek. It also tells us to eliminate Amalek. So, Mameila. Yoitzi with that Parsha. Right? We have in the end of Parsha's Vashalach. We have the Parsha that we read on Purim. we have there. We don't have the mitzvah, we have ki, the loshen, the exact loshen is ki mocho emche zeichar amolik mitachas ha-shamoyim. We don't have the tzivoy per se, but the Rebbe Shalom says ki mocho emche, the symbol is ki mocho emche zeichar amolik. So Rashi tells us that implies the timcha, which is in Parshas Ki Seitzei, lekachani masirecho kein. Why do I tell you kimocha yemcha? Ki chofetz ani lemchaisei. I'm telling you to carry this out because that's what I want. I don't want them in the world. So this parsha also alludes to mechias amolik, lochomal Hashem ba'amolik midor dor. So the Morgan Aram says some amein that this guy will be yaitzer with this parsha. It's also a parsha of amolik. So Mamele might as well come Purim. Purim gets a double header, two for the price of one. So the Chofetz Chaim says he's unsure about this, because it doesn't have all the details. It says, Vayovo Amalek, Vilochem, Yisrael, Berafidim. But all the evil of Amalek, Asher Kor Chobaderech, Vizanem Chokhla Nechoshol, Vato Evelo Yorei Elokim. So all of this detail is not found in Parshas B'Shalach. And the Chofetz Chaim feels that Parshas Amolek is not only to talk about the necessity of Mochel Emcha Zecher Amolek, but exactly what they did, which incurred the wrath of the Rebbeinu Shel, which is only very slightly alluded to. Vayovo Amolek, Vayilochem Emisor Berfidim. But everything that took place is not really fully described. So the Chofetz Chaim says he's not sure if he yates to it. So there we remain with the dispute. So that's in terms of the halachas of Parsha Zohar. Are women chuyiv in Parsha Zohar? So Baruch Hashem, based on the way our community is structured and works today, the women generally do participate in Parsha Zohar. We don't know a clear-cut reason that they shouldn't be chuyiv. I mean, there are those, I think you'll know if you look in the Sefer HaChinuch and the Minchas Chinuch, that suggest that the mitzvah Schiras Amalek is tied together with the command of Timcha Zecher Amalek. So those that are commanded in Timcha Zecher Amalek are commanded in Zohar Eis Asher Osa Lecha Amalek. So based on that, it would come out that women are not obligated in Zohar, because this really is a charge to wage battle. That's not the woman's responsibility. But again, that's not a very clear-cut thing. So, on balance, if they could come to Parsha Zohar, it's a good idea, which is what we're very widespread nowadays.
It is a Melchemes Mitzvah, so women are in the support role, correct? I mean, right? And they say there that even the men who are in the support role share in the booty, whatever it is, so they would be considered part of the Milchama.
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, the Radva says that their role was, and I just don't know if in the context of Milchemes Amalek, the defensive war, I would see more possible. Because the Radva writes that what was woman's role? Woman's role was to be the support for her own husband. That's what the Radva writes. Not to be in the general army. So, in a defensive war, I could conceive of that. It's hard to imagine when you're going out of your own territory, how that would work. So, I don't know. So the Radva says, what is her role? Her role is she's supposed to be the support for her husband. Bring the bullets to him. Put into the gun. Make sure that he's fed, able to keep on firing. So, Rav Moshe Zatzal asked one of my friends from Kamal Winter, Zatzalik Levrocha. He asked Rav Moshe about it. He was Mashamash Rav Moshe for 3 years. And Rav Moshe told him, in the shtetlach in Europe, the minhag was women did not attend Parsha Zohar. Talking the Litvish shtetlach. But as I say, nowadays, to the largest extent, we do. And wherever possible, we try very, very hard that the women should participate.
Was it a minhag, or was it just a practical issue? They
I don't know. He told Rav Moshe felt that Mitzar Adin that was correct. Mikra Adin. In other words, if it was hard for a woman to come, whatever, she didn't have to go nuts to come. That's what he felt.
Is this like a mitzvah cessation Zman Grama, or it's different?
Well, I don't know if it's a Zman Grama, because there's no particular Zman. You can do it any time during the year.
I'm saying, in other words, is there, by mitzvah cessation Zman Grama, if women do it, so there's a
Kiyama Mitzvah. Yeah, this is more than that, I would. If them Chuyiv, it's more than that, because there's no Zman Grama. You could do it.
Pashkas Menatur.
What?
They may not be
Mechuyiv altogether, but not because of Zman Grama.
Right.
Because it's not a Zman Grama, because Midrash, you could do it 365 days a year.
Right, but if they're not Mechuyiv at all, they may not be Kiyam at all.
No, it could be. No, you would still get us. Because if you learn Mitzvah Seisha Zman Grama, they're potter from. So the reason that there is a mitzvah is since this in Klal Yisrael is a mitzvah of the Advar Hashem, and they have Kedushas Yisrael, so Mamela, there is a Kiyam. The issue of the bracha sometimes could come out if they can say with Tzivona one such a thing. That's one of the issues in the bracha. If they could possibly say with Tzivona, they're not mechuyev at all. You want to do it, they're good. You got tzchar, it's a maisa mitzvah.
Yeah, isn't this listed amongst the six
of Kharos
that you could say every day?
That's what I'm saying. It's not a mitzvah Shazman Ram. You could do it until 365 days a year.
You don't see it without listening to the lady. Like just saying
yeah, if you don't have an opportunity to listen to the laning, let's say a person was someplace for a whole year, you were in Siberia and you had lo, like the people were back in the time of the second one, had no saving. So good, so one, at least once a year, she had to recite the piano, Zohar Isa Shar also
the
Chal Malik.
And the
Yotzi,
the
Raisa? Yeah, the Raisa, the Yotzi. That's Pashtus, yeah.
Theoretically, if there was no leap year, you could satisfy it on Parshas Ki Teisefer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if everyone had to write Kavana?
So, well, we have any other problem, because I wonder if we do it in Adar, and there's a leap year, so we're still, the next year, we're still 13 months away.
Okay.
You know, either way, you know, we wind up with that problem.
They always make that announcement, they always say, those who missed it, pay attention now.
Yeah.
You get to have in mind.
Then the Yaitzi were all the dinner that the Rabbanon made, if let's say assuming it's the Rabbanon to read from a Sefer Torah, but with the whole nine yachts. So those are the etzim of the dinner of Parsha Zochon, that it's so, the Chofetz Chaim, Zatzal wrote that we should say Zecher and Zecher because it's a Sophic. The one apparently that started this tumult of the Sophic was the Radak in the Sefer HaMichla. Now, there was Rav Mordechai Breuer. Mordechai Breuer was Ayida Talmud Chacham in Eretz Yisrael. He was related to the Breuer family. He was a nephew, I believe, of Rav Breuer from the Washington Heights. He was his nephew, and he wrote a very lengthy article. He was one, maybe the foremost expert in the world, probably, in terms of the mikra itself. The digduk and mikra and everything involved with mikra, and the mesora of mikra. So he wrote that with all that we know today, we should go back to doing just zocher and not zecher. He said they discovered an Eretz Yisrael, it was very interesting. They have the Keter Aram Tzova. What's known in English, the Aleppo Codex, right? Which the Rambam was made, was Le'elo in terms of its, text. So they found that someone, Ayida Talmud Chacham in Yerushalayim, had written to the secretary of the who was in charge of the Keter Aram Tova, and people used to ask him questions, and he would write back according to what was in the Keter. So one of the questions they found, actually, it almost wound up in a Geniz, and someone realized what it was, the hundreds of questions that he asked, and the answers are the masker. So we have even the parts that are missing. We're missing like 4.5 chumashim from the, we're missing parts, almost, 4.5, or a little bit more. Almost the whole chumash is missing. So first they thought it's burned. Now I think we believe it's not burned, someone absconded with it. That's what they believe. But I'll call upon him. So one of the questions that was asked was, does it say Zecher or Zecher? And he responded that in the Keter it says Zecher. It doesn't say Zecher.
The
Kudus. Yeah, it has the Kudus, yeah. That's... Yeah, and He mentions the fact that Rav Breuer in Washington Heights only did Zecher. Never did not adopt Zecher at all. And he wrote many, many proofs that Zecher, the Chorov Chaim Volozhin says the Gros said Zecher. He says the report that we have in the Gros name that Zecher and Meiser Rav does not have the authority that Rav Chaim Volozhin has. So he deduced many, many proofs that what's correct is Zecher. Zecher is, he says, the Radak was a writer on Digduk, but it was never considered a major force in the Messiah in that regard. So that was his conclusion. He felt, Al Kaponim Ayetzim, he calls us like this. I couldn't dare institute such a thing if I wanted to do it, because everybody would run next door to hear a Kriya get the word Yetzim, you know? But there is a Nafkamina. The Nafkamina is that which one do you do second? This is a very interesting R, and I'm grateful. We had a few years back Professor Aviezer Frankel was here. So this is one of his passions, you know. Digduk is a passion of his text. So he argued that whenever you do something twice, misofik, so the final one ought to be the right one. That's where you let it go, leave off. Now, what's also relevant, it happens to be in the Megillas Esther. We have two places that we read twice. We have Ishlo Amad Bifneim, and the other is the question if we the word has Ishlo Amad Hashmi Larog or Vilarog. Yeah. So we find again in the Kisvayad, we find that it should be that Lifneim is correct and Vilarog is correct. The whole source where this came from altogether is a source that we should not be. We shouldn't be overly busy with the source that told us the other versions. So Mordechai Breuer wrote that clearly the correct versions are Lifneim and Velarig.
That should be in the Keter.
But it's in all the sources that we have, in the Keter or anything, Leningrad, wherever we have sources, that's the way it is. I mean, these sources were not available 100 years ago, they're available today.
So why do we do it the other way?
Can't change what people are used to. Again, I'll dare to do such a thing. No one will come to listen to the Megillah in the shul and decide
where
that
they,
I.
Where did it come from?
Because somebody had put out a version of the Mikros Gedolos, the earlier versions, and I don't want to talk too much about who the person was and what. He's not a person that we ought to be overly concerned about historically. Okay? He became a Meshumet at the end of his life. Okay? That's the basic story on it. So it's not a source, and it didn't have real sources behind it. Whatever, it's a mistake, and that's all. But I can't change the world. But again, the nafkamina is which ones you do second. So you should do. We do Lifneim second, and Velarik second for that reason.
But don't most people do Zecher before Zecher?
Well, you should do it in the reverse. I happen to read that Professor Frankel is correct. You should do Zecher first and Zecher second.
But if you read the whole passage twice, so now I understand if you know,
even that, you
so
know.
Then you've already been Yotzei the first time.
If you read the whole passage, maybe, but so you still want to end up with what's correct, not with what's incorrect.
Well, you've already gotten in the check. You already did.
I guess you can't undo it.
Is the way that it works that you're like making a tanai that if the first one isn't right,
well,
the
it's not a tanai. You read it. You have to read it. You read it. That's all. If you read it, you read reading A, reading B. One of them is right, so you read it.
Should you read the passage twice, or should you just read the word?
This is Rav Soloveitchik. Zatzal was the one that was in favor of reading the whole passage twice. And I believe the reason he felt it would be a violation, I think, of called pasuk below paske vayishanan lo paskin, and sort of making up our own pasuk, you know, we're breaking the pasuk in half and going back again, whatever. I believe that that's where he was coming from. I'm not 100% sure, but most of the world just does the phrase, which is it.
Why don't make such a big deal with it anyway? You'd be
Yotze.
Wouldn't you be Yotze if you read
Zecher? The Chayre Yotze, because it's for the rice, and you want to do it right. You know.
I won't stop that.
Now, what happens to me, it's a digdig, because in Smicha, sometimes, that when you have a Tzeira and that type of word, that it's Smicha, so in fact it does change into a Segel in certain, you know, certain words. So apparently that's the Shaila here. Does Zecher have the same, not that there's no word Zecher, I don't think anyone's claiming that. There is a word Zecher. The question is, when it says Zecher Amalek, or Zecher Amalek, but it's in Smichut, then it's a Shaila if it changes into a Segel or it stays at Tzeira. That's, I believe, what the Machloikis is. But these are the halachic aspects.
I once done the Minyan Eretz Yisrael, and after the Minyan, Shabbat Zohar, they had someone read a Temani, because I assume this is where it was, just in case that's the right way to read it, so then I wasn't really Yotzei, because
I'm
not pronouncing
it. I'm a Yotzei. Where Moshe Zatzal wrote when it comes to anything which with the Raisa needs Loshon Kodesh, and the Mishnah Saita lists a whole slew of things which have to be in Loshon Kodesh. So he asked a very simple question, ever the practical-minded person. He says, tell me, he says, Chalitza has to be in Lashon Kodesh. So he says, what happens if there was a Hasidish guy and it came to Vilna to do Chalitza? You know, for his sister-in-law. He says, do you think that the best made him learn Litvisha for Ivra before we let him do the Chalitza? He says, Lahoy v'lein Ivra, we let him do the Hasidish Avara too. Vice Khalid Sanu, you know.
Is there an assumption that one way to pronounce is really right? We just don't know.
The assumption is the following. I don't have the cheshbon of it. I don't know the European languages. My shver, Zalazangazan Stark, was masber to me once that the different, in other words, for example, the ones that say U, the ones that say E, etc., have to do with the varied pronunciations of the European languages and their vowels, the vowelization of those languages, where the people spoke that way. And each country picked up, you know, our vowels. Why do we have the O? Everyone says a cholim for O. There's no one on the face of this earth before American Jewry that was alive in the last, you know, that anyone have ever met that said O for a cholim. Svartim don't say O. They don't. They don't say oi and they don't say o. The Sfardim have, it's almost closer to a kometz, like to say in Eretz Rechov. They don't say Rechov, Rechov.
And the Litvish said A, right?
The Litvish said A.
Yeah.
And the Mochsidish style Jews, the other Jews, the non-Litvish said oi. Which is also apparently pretty clearly a mistake. Because now what's the difference between o and oi?
Doesn't it
pass
a lot of Hasidic pronunciation?
What? Listen, our pronunciations are equally flawed. You know, there was a Yid, I don't know why, but the Satmar Rebbe Zatzal had something. He must have been some type of wise guy, so the Satmar Rebbe decided to put him in his place. So he came to the Tish once, and he asked the Rebbe, he says, I always wondered since I'm a child, why there are three letters... in the Hebrew language that are all pronounced the same way, a sin, a samach, and a sof. Why do we need three pronounced the same way? So the Satmar Rebbe turned back to the Tish and he says, that's why there's a pasuk which says, ad mosai ksilim taskilu, which is unbelievable. Mosai is with a sof, ksila with a samach, and taskilu with a sin.
Is it a legitimate question?
The question is legitimate, because the real answer is, that's why Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal held that the Temanim was the closest, was probably true. The Temanim have, in fact, every letter is different. The Vav is a Wu sound. That's what a Wu sound is. And the Dalet, I think, with the Dogish is a Thu sound. There's a lot of sounds we don't have. I don't know what it's going to be, but we're going to go back to... I don't know a Gimel with a Dogish, how they pronounce... It's very, very difficult for me. There was once a cook in Chofetz Chaim, his name was Tzion, he was a Temani, and I was friendly with him. So I asked him once to come in and just read a little for me. I wanted to hear him read. And I read the pasuk, Loig Echad Shaman. I could not even replicate. My ear couldn't pick up the way he pronounced that gimel. It just couldn't lock in on the sound. I don't know what he said.
Rabbi, if you're going to go with the Hungarian goat, Shannon Hasidish, and they got three ways of saying E, and they have no U in their whole language. So every single man turned every single man into a woman. And I don't see how you're ever going to be Yotzei Elaining if every single one of them is.
So that's why. So Rav Moshe Zatzal wrote that Yotzei Loshon Kodesh, as long as it's a community that pronounces that way, it's acceptable as Loshon Kodesh.
So if the person says instead of Asher, he calls him, who calls him Midianis, he says he calls him Midianis.
No,
changed everything.
But if that's the way his whole community pronounces it, Rav Moshe said Yeitzi the Din Loshon Kodesh. I grew up in a shtibel. We used to daven there Friday night, and Shabbos afternoon, because the shul that we daven was very far from my house. So there was a Galatiana. These are Polish and Galatiana guys, so Aaron was there. So one of them, Mort Chomenkis, if you remember. Yeah. So he was the Balkria, and he was a real Galatiana. So the guys like my father, they were grew up in America, and they went to literacy, you know, yeshivas, Chaim Berlin, and whatever they went to, but they didn't learn the Chassidish Havar. So they used to go nuts from the Galatianas. So one time there was a word, it's written Hevav Aleph, and it's a Creek Siv, it's he. So we said he. So he says, I run it up, said, oh, he finally got it right. So we do try to go to a kehila for Parsha Zoha, which has our own pronunciation for that reason. That's, you know, that's Amasur.
Do we understand why the Havarasra did pronounce the Saf and the Tav the same way? Is that...
That's also...
There was a separate
letter called the Sa. So that's why. In Taman, they don't have it. They're selling it. Every one of the things outside the Taman, he wants, will ask these kashas, and we have no answers. Because the answers are that the sounds were difficult to produce. The Russians don't say a hey sound. They say a gimel instead of a hey. They say a gimel instead of a hey. The town that my father comes from is Ostra, with a hey at the end. The Russians call it Ostrog. And Kahina v'Kahina, they say they have a gu sound instead of a hu sound. The hu sound didn't make it in their language.
So why is it that we're all considered Yotze? Just because?
That's what Rav Moshe wrote. If there's, it's widespread that he didn't talk in that fashion, it's Yotze that didn't Loshon Kodesh. Chaz de Hashem for that. Otherwise, it'd really be in trouble. Now, what I did want to look at is the Haftarah for Parsha Zohar. The Haftarah for Parsha Zohar is a complicated after, very complicated. So I decided to be my ayin. I always had one kash at the end, but the whole story of what happened there. The Sfardim begin, and the truth is, according to the Malbim, it's really probably well advised that they do. Vayom Shmuel or Shol, Oisi Sholach Hashem Nimshocha Cholam Melech. Alam O'al Yisrael, the Rebbe Shalom asked me to appoint you to be, to anoint you. Now, the Ashkenazim don't begin from where we start Kol Hashem, Hashem Tzvokus, Bakati, about the Tzivu, about Amalek. But as the Malbim explains, that this Havdomah is a very, very important one. Because this Havdomah, this Posek, we find, and he brings us in Sefer Ikorim, this is a major theme that's talked about. That Dovra Melech did have Eris in his life. He wrote a whole Mizmor Dunalov, the Mizmor of Tshuva, and whatever. The Rebbe Shalom didn't kick him out. The Rebbe Shalom accepted that he was a very saintly person. Shaul HaMelech sinned, and the Rebbe Shalom throws him out. Why? What's the reason for that? So the Malbim traces a number of reasons. First, he quotes the Sefer Ikarim, or Yosef Albo, and this is really rooted in the pasuk that we Ashkenazim don't say. Vayomer Hashem Shmuel Oshol Oisi Sholach Yom Shmuel Oshol Oisi Sholach Hashem Nimshochach Al Melech Al Amor Yisrael V'Ato Shmuel Kol Divrei Hashem. The responsibility of the king is to listen to the Rebbe Shalom. Means in carrying out his responsibilities of his office, not his personal life, his office is to listen to the Kol Hashem. That's his responsibility. He has a private life. He has to serve the Rebbe Hashem privately, but that's not the definition of what he has to do in office. And this is what Rav Yosef Albo says, this was the difference between Shaul and David. Shaul, in many regards, was a greater tzaddik. Gemara says in Yuma, and then David HaMelech was. I chol ba'achas v'loy olsalo. The Rebbe Nishan didn't let him off the hook. And David b'shtayim, and the Rebbe Nishan let him forgive him. Why? Because the chet of Shaul was a violation of the oath of office. David HaMelech were private indiscretions. Private indiscretions, okay. You don't have to be thrown out of office because of private indiscretions. And so Shaul erred that he did not, the Reuven Shalom told him that your mandate is to carry out that which the Reuven Shalom wants. And he didn't do it. So this was a violation of his oath of office. That's issue number one. So where the Sfardim begin is actually a very telling beginning to the story. Then he writes the following: Koyomar Hashem Tzvokus Bokati Yisrael Moso Also Amolik the Yisrael Asher Somlo Baderach Baalo Yisomim Mitzrayim. He says in the Chumash we find that there are five aspects of the Chet of Amolik. He says normally and Lo Aleinu. This is a very, very important thing to realize. In Nazism, Yimach Shalom B'Zichrom, had many of these same things. Normally, you wage a war, he says, for one of five reasons. One is that you want to conquer a land. You know, you want more, you have a bigger country, so you want to conquer land. So that's why it says here that Klai Yisrael Somlo Baderach. They had nothing to conquer. They didn't control any of it. So there was nothing. There was no reason to wage war against them for that reason. Second is sometimes you go to war to defend yourself. Someone puts their army on your border, so you attack them. Here, what they would say is Chamei Mitzrayim. They weren't near Amalek altogether. Number three. Sometimes they have a history between, they have enmity between these two countries. So they fight. Like India and Pakistan, they have a long history. So any day that you wake up and they're shooting at each other, you don't have any kashas. The kashas the other way. When they're not shooting at each other, you wonder why not. Right? They fought right in 60 years' time, four or five wars between them. So Nishkin Kasha. They have different religions and they have disputes, land disputes. So they're always, you know, they're at each other's throats. Sometimes a country wants to establish itself as a world power. So it sets off on conquest for the sake of establishing its power in the world. Not even necessarily for what the significance of what its conquests are, but just merely to establish that it's a world power. And this also didn't happen because there was Hulu they attack, Kolonacha Sholim Vato Yevyogeya. You attack the defenseless, the stragglers, you know. This is not a way to prove you're a world class power because you threw grenades and you blew a few people up, you know. Nobody in the world is taking note of you for that reason. And sometimes the reason is that you have a different religion. Right? How many wars did the Muslims and the Christians fight in history? Because of religious differences. He says, but Amalek, basically, they were atheistic. They didn't recognize the Ribbono Shel Olam at all. So they had no reason to fight against somebody that had a religion. They had no religious differences. Religion didn't play a role by them. So why did they wage war? Because they wanted to spread their kfirah. That there's no Ribbono Shel Olam, nobody, whatever, we can do whatever we want in this world and there's no one to stand in our way. Don't have this mysis with Kriyas Yamsu, forget about it, it's all, you know, it's a garnished. So this was a war waged against the Ribbono Shel Olam. So this is why this is alluded to here we allude to two other reasons, Asher Somlo Baderach. Number one, that there was no land to conquer, and number two, there weren't a threat to anyone. Baloi Sami Mitzrayim. And this Rabbi said, this is the ultimate evil of Nazism. Yimach Shalom Lezichron. There was nothing to fight the Jews for. We were in no position to be a threat to them. We didn't have an army. We had nothing. We didn't possess anything. We didn't have a land. You know, you want to go conquer Poland, so conquer Poland. Okay, that's what you want to do. You want to conquer land. But there was nothing that you want from Klal Yisrael. Nothing at all. That's what we'll read in this week's parasha. Asom lo baderach v'alo yisim v'shan. This is Nazi using Yimach Shemom v'zichron. The Arabs are a different cheshbon. We cannot compare the Arabs to Nazism. Sunni Israel, yes, but not the Nazis. The Arabs want something. Two things the Arabs want. Number one, they want the land. And number two, there's a religious issue too. It's sort of how in the world do these Jews stand in the way of Islam? You know, right smack in the middle of the whole Arab world. So their war against Klal Yisrael and Yishmael is not without reason. Might be unreasonable, but it's not without reason. Yeah.
I think they it's more that they don't want us to have it than they really want.
Whatever it is, they are disturbed that we're there. So they want at least whatever their reasons, evil that they may be, but there's a goal. They're trying to do something. It's not just stop, you know, we hate the Jews. That's also true in the Arab world, but this is beyond the hatred of Eretz Yisrael is beyond that. Nazism had none of those features. And it's interesting, you know, in the secular world, it took them a very, very long time to lock in on this part. In the late 1970s, I was in Eretz Yisrael then, and then they came out in the American media was broadcast something about Nazism. It was in the whole world at that time. And, you know, what Nazism was and its effect on the Jews, etc., was broadcast. I don't remember who created it. But one of the things they managed to push across, and that really escaped the world until then, was that killed the Jews without any reason. There was no reason. Nothing was accomplished by doing this. Now, the interesting thing is that the Satmar Rebbe Zatzal, this was crystal clear to him from day one. Crystal clear to him. Whatever he made of it, but the observation that they killed us for zero reason whatsoever was crystal clear to him. He had immediately that perspective on the Holocaust. That's Nazism. That was Amalek. There's nothing to gain but his whole world. Now, so the Rebbeinu Shalom, because they came to wage war against Hashem, so the Rebbeinu Shalom is an enmity for them. Now, here's where we get into a very, very important point. We're Shaul. So one is that he was a king and he didn't carry out his responsibilities. The Rebbeinu Shalom told him, "Atolech v'kisos amalik v'choram tosam tos kol asher lo. Olay sach moel olo v'imato v'yish harish amel olo v'yonek v'shor v'atzem v'gom v'at chama." So that's the first thing. The second thing is that why didn't he eliminate the cattle of Amalek? Vayachmel Shaul va'omel Agog va'meita va'tzayin va'boka va'mishne va'lakorim va'kol atoyim. Le'ovu acharimu. So it's a shaila how this will come back to how it applies to Agog. The Malbim tells us that there's a difference between chos and chemba. There's a difference. What did Shaul do? Vayachmo pobir atam ha-shenim adu'alo niskabli tshuvos ha-shoshua. Chomol chus and rachim. They're all similar before to having compassion. But he says there's a big difference between them. That rachamim is because I have compassion on a person. I don't have it within me to kill a person. So I have compassion on him. or on his difficulty. Chemlon chus atum tzal kol dom. So first, rachamim is on a person. That's number one. The hevdu v'neiim shachus atiyem it's a tzorcha wal adomer. Chus is for something that I need. Since I need it, I have a feeling for it because it's something that I need. A chos odom amamono, Chazal said. A person is chos on his moment. Why? Because he needs his money. So he's chos amamono. Chemlo, he said, is not a matter of need. Chemlo is a philosophical stance. I have no need for it at all. Raksha shayvit b'sichloi, my seichel tells me, shayim roi lahashchis adomarahu. It's better that it should be around. I don't need it, but it's a philosophical statement. I don't need lions in the world. You know. It's not, not one of my big priorities. I have to be able to go to the zoo and see a lion. So what do I need a lion for? So if there won't be any lions in the world, I'm not benefiting from the fact that there are lions. But my seichel tells me if the Rebbeinu Shem created a min in the world, that min should exist. We shouldn't wipe it off the face of the earth. He created lions, he created tigers, elephants, leopards. They're part of the Bria, so we should not destroy the Rebbeinu Shem's Bria. So that's a statement not of utilitarianism. That's a statement of philosophy. That I believe that they have a place in the world. They should be. Do I need it? No, I don't want anything to do with the lion. Let them stay in Africa and stay in the zoo far away from me. But there should be lions in the world. The Malbu says that's what it means that Vayachmoel Shol. That Shol had, Vayachmoel Shol was a philosophical statement. That it's just to waste all of these animals, to put them to waste, is inappropriate and improper. And he says, this then is not, if it was chos, that, listen, there's a lot of money here. You don't take millions and millions of dollars and just throw it out. We have a lot to do with millions of dollars. We could support a lot of yeshivas, we could bring a lot of kabbalists, there's what to do with it. That's not what motivated him. What motivated him is vayachma. Just, not that he needed to have it, he didn't need it. But you don't waste, waste not, want not. Don't waste.
Doesn't that magnify the kasha? But Hashem said he had destroyed it.
So what did he say? What did he decide to do? Yeah, he's going to get rid of it. He's going to bring it for a korban. It'll be destroyed. But I'll destroy it in a way that it's useful, Hashem Shemayim. But this is already a philosophical, he says. So this is a very, very grave chet. This is a chet in deus already, the Malbim writes. Because he came, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam told him to destroy it. And he has his own idea. No, this is not the right way. I have a different way to do it.
So why didn't the Malbim say that was the difference between Dovid and Shel?
He has many differences. He points out there are many. He's quoted Sefer HaYikarim at this point. He has a number of differences. And he's not finished yet.
It's really not there to allow them.
No, there is. The Chazon Ish writes. He says a person. The Chazon Ish wrote that in Sefer the Kundras and Amunah and Bitochen, that a world that's lacking, that was a liar, there's something, there's a regish that tells me something's missing in the world. It's Chosr. Chazon Ish wrote that. Chazon Ish had a very, we look at the Chazon Ish from the judicial standpoint, the legalistic standpoint. But if you read the Kuntres and Amunah Bitochon, you realize the Chazon Ish had a very lyrical heart. The regish of all that yid was off the charts. So he says, once if it won't be in the world, he says, well, margish, this chos, it's missing. It's something that lacking in the brain. There was a third aspect to the chet of Shaul. I don't think we're going to finish tonight. But there was a third aspect in the Chet of Shaul. And this is a theme which plays through, which I don't want to spend too much time on tonight because I won't be able to finish. But Shaul was unable to acknowledge that he erred. And there many times Shmuel tells him that something's wrong, and Shaul comes back and still defends that which he did. He says, even his defense, when he gave finally at the end, his final defense was that the nation pushed them into it. And that's why he did it. So Shmuel didn't accept that either. He says it wasn't true. He says, why? He says, because what I would say at the beginning, how did Shaul become the Melech? Sholachash, he sent the Novi. Right? There are two ways that you become Melech. You become Melech because the Rabbeinu Shalom, you put yourself in, if you're a powerful king, you can put yourself in office. Or if you're not that type to put yourself in office, the Rabbeinu Shalom puts you into office. The Rabbeinu Shalom was Boicher in Shaul, and the Rabbeinu sent the Novi and he put him into office. He didn't ask the people to appeal to Shaul to become the Melech. This didn't come from the people, it came from the top down. He says, if the people decide that they need a leader and they put you into office, right, through the varied mechanisms, however, whatever each particular political class in the society works, right? In the Soviet Union, yeah, there was a guy that they put on the top, but that guy was dependent on a lot, except Stalin managed to kill everybody that put him into office. So he didn't, you know, he understood that if they put you into office, they could take you out of office. So what did he do? In the years 1936-1937, it's mind-boggling. I mean, forget that he probably killed 40, 50 million people. But forget that. The power in the Soviet Union was in the Central Committee of the Communist Party. It was made up of 1,900 people. 1,300 of them in the years 1936-1937, he sent off to Siberia to make sure that they would never have any problems ever from them. But so if they put you into power, they could take you out of power. But Shmuel tells Shaul, the people didn't put you into power. The Rabbeinu Shalom put you in. So you don't have to be afraid of the people. If they put you in, they could say they don't like what you're doing. They'll kick you out tomorrow. But they had no say in putting you in. So they can't throw you out either. So these are the deficiencies of Shaul. We're going to go through next time, but from next week. What? That is Purim. Maybe we'll touch on Purim also. We'll have enough time. It's the second half of Daf Torah. It'll be timely, right, people, of Parsha Zohar. The exchanges between Shmuel and Shaul. And also there's a very enigmatic ending. And it always troubled me, but I was my and the Malbim is a very nice pshat. At the end, he tells him, Shmuel... Shaul asked him to come and first he tells him the following, Shaul. V'ato sono es chatosi, forgive my sin, v'shuvi mi v'shtacha b'el Hashem. And Shaul tells him, lo'yoshuvi moch, ki ma'asta esdra Hashem v'yimosch Hashem v'yos melech. He says, come and I'll bow down to Hashem. Shaul says, I won't go with you. You're out. Then at the end of the after, Shaul asks him again, V'yishtachavisi l'Hashem alokecha. And v'yom v'shmuel acharei Shaul, v'yer yoshev shmuel acharei Shaul, v'yishtachu Shaul l'Hashem. So what changed? First he tells him off, forget about it, you're gone. And then he tells him, kabdeini, you know? And then he agrees and he goes with him. So what changed? So we'll examine that too. The Malbim is a very nice explication of that part. So Be'ez Hashem, we're going to do the second half of the after Be'ez Hashem next week, and then we'll go into the Halacha Sepro.
Professor Frankel's son, by the way, I don't know if you know much about him. He's working on the Graz Parish on Yerushalmi. And say the drawings.
Because
I saw him there recently, the son.
What does he live someplace
in Rehavia? Within two blocks of probably Yeshiva and Netzach Yisrael.
Oh, that's where he is. I thought he lived in Malay Adunim.
אני בצדיק איך זה פניך, אז אני מדבר דקה לפני התקורם. נותנים אוכל למשפחות. יש לנו כמעט 2,400 משפחות שנותנים בחגים, בשבתות יש לנו...